Lecture 19 today, we will start applying what we've studied so far to a specific cosmological model. Now, the realistic standard model of cosmology holds that the very early universe underwent a short period of almost exponential expansion, which is called the inflationary period. And eventually we will study the most realistic scenario. But in the meantime, as a preparation, let's study something that is a little bit idealized, but still quite close to what eventually the standard model is going to be. Namely, let us study quantum field theory in the Sitter space. The Sitter space is a particular Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space-time, and it's the case where the scale factor takes this particular form. So the scale factor is increasing exponentially, and it's doing so forever. So this is not a good model for cosmic inflation, because cosmic inflation is supposed to have lasted only a very, very short amount of time. The Sitter universe is a universe that's always exponentially expanding and has always been. It also doesn't have a Big Bang. See, you can have T arbitrarily negative. T is the proper time as measured on the wristwatch of a freely floating observer. So the Sitter universes don't have a start time or end time. And just keep expanding exponentially. The constant H is called the Hubble constant, and notice that the larger the Hubble constant is, the faster is the universe expanding, or the higher is the acceleration with which the universe is expanding. So large H means large expansion. Now I'm simplifying things a little bit by saying that the Sitter space is the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space-time, where this is the scale factor, because the Sitter space actually is a very highly symmetric space. It has as many symmetries as Minkowski space had. And there are different ways you can slice this space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, such that it looks a little different, actually, from this. But it won't help us for our cosmological studies, so I will just leave it to you as an exercise to read the little paragraph that Mukhanov and Vinitsky have about the Sitter space in their textbook. So for us, the Sitter space is the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space-time, which has this scale factor. We are choosing to slice space-time in such a way that this is the expansion rate. Now it turns out that the Sitter space has a horizon. Now what's a horizon? We look at what a horizon is from two perspectives. What does a horizon mean for point particles or observers, travelers, tourists? And the other perspective is, what does a horizon mean for waves? It's a big difference, because waves are delocalized things and particles are localized. Both feel the presence of a horizon, but they feel it differently. Let's look at first how particles notice the presence of the horizon in the Sitter. The proposition that we will prove is that objects, or any observer, who are further apart from each other than a proper distance of 2 over h can never meet, and they cannot communicate. So let's say we have two galaxies whose proper distance is more than 2 over the Hubble constant. Then the claim is that they can never meet, and they also cannot communicate. Clearly, if the expansion rate is higher, which is to say if H is large, the Hubble constant is large, then that horizon distance is a small one, right? Because it's 1 over H. Fast expansion means H is large. H is equal to 0 means Minkowski space. So the horizon of the Sitter space is not located at a particular point or in a particular surface or something like that. It's not like the case of black holes where they are, where it is at a particular radius. No, every observer in the Sitter space has a the Sitter horizon, which is at a fixed distance from that observer. And that distance is 1 over h, or 2 over h when you ask if they can ever meet. So let's prove this. And by the way, this way we will also see under which condition a universe has a horizon. Not just the De Sitter case, which has one, but there are many universes, many FRW solutions to cosmology which have horizons. So let us consider an observer in a galaxy A. We want to prove that statement above, right? That there is this horizon, 1 over h or 2 over h. Consider an observer in a galaxy A. And then let us choose this to be this observer to sit at the origin of the coordinate system. Origin of the proper distance coordinate system or co-moving both, right? Now, let's say that this observer is sending out a signal at a starting time TS towards a galaxy B. We want to find out under which condition that signal will reach the galaxy B or will not reach the galaxy B. See, if it doesn't reach the galaxy B, it is because even though the signal is traveling at the speed of light, we are imagining here an electromagnetic signal, even though it's traveling at the speed of light, and so light is doing its best to cross as much distance as possible quickly, space is actually expanding between the two galaxies A and B at a rate sufficiently large that more distance is being created per unit time than light can cross. Right? So where is that threshold? Obviously, if the two galaxies are very close to each other, then it's sufficient to travel with speed of light to go from A to B. But if they're really far apart from each other, then maybe space gets created in between them at a higher rate than light can cross space. OK, let's calculate that. Our electromagnetic signal that A is sending to B will travel in a small time interval delta t, a small co-moving distance that we may call delta x. How big is that co-moving distance that an electromagnetic signal can travel during the time delta t? Well, we have to remember two things. Speed of light is a proper speed. It's the proper distance traveled per proper time that is limited by the speed of light constant c. Another thing to remember is that the co-moving distance translates into the proper distance by multiplying with the scale factor. Right? Remember that, for example, two galaxies will always have numerically the same co-moving distance. They just drift apart, but the co-moving coordinate system is drifting, is expanding along with that. So numerically, the co-moving distance between two galaxies always stays the same. The proper distance is obtained by taking the co-moving distance and multiplying with the scale factor. So what we have is that the electromagnetic signal that A is emitting is traveling in a short amount of time delta t. The distance, the co-moving distance delta x, which is the proper distance A times delta x. So since this is light, the signal is light, it is traveling this proper distance divided by that proper time with the speed of light, c, which in our units is 1. Okay, so scale factor times co-moving distance, proper distance, divided by proper time as measured on a wristwatch is equal to 1. All right, so let's bring this factor A of t on the other side. And then we have delta x over delta t, or in the limit, dx by dt equal to A inverse, inverse of the scale factor, where x, remember, is the co-moving distance. Okay, so the co-moving velocity of light is given by 1 over the scale factor. What that means is that as the universe is expanding and the scale factor grows, the co-moving velocity of light goes down, which it has to be, because at late times when the universe has a huge scale factor A, well then any small delta x co-moving distance really means a huge distance, a proper distance, right? So the speed of light, the co-moving speed of light has to go down as the universe is expanding just because of the translation between proper and co-moving. All right, now in the case of the sitter space-time, the scale factor as a function of time goes like e to the power of minus ht, right? The scale factor goes like e to the power of plus ht, but here we are dealing with the inverse, so that's how it goes. That's great, we can integrate this and obtain the co-moving distance that the beam of light is crossing as a function of proper time. So what we obtain is that the co-moving distance that our beam of light is crossing from the origin where observer A is sitting towards observer B, that co-moving distance is the integral of that. Integral of that exponential is, of course, this term here, plus an integration constant, which expresses our initial condition here in time. So we have as initial condition that the observer starts at position zero. Let's implement that to fix what this integration constant is. So we want to fix the integration constant such that the position of the beam of light at the starting time when the beam of light was emitted is equal to zero. So in this formula, if we put there for t the starting time, and by that I mean time the beam was emitted by observer A, then the position ought to be zero. So clearly this means that c has to be that term in order for the sum of these two to be zero at t equal to ts. Therefore, the position of the beam of light from A to B, from galaxy A to galaxy B, in terms of co-moving, the co-moving coordinate system, is given by this expression here. This being a constant that is variable in time. So now, let's give this beam of light some time. Let it travel. As it travels, this term here is time dependent. That term here is fixed, however. And what we find is that as t goes to infinity, this term goes away, and we are left with just that term. So if we give the beam of light an infinite amount of time to travel, then even if you wait infinitely long, the maximum distance that the beam of light can travel is this distance. It's not that it hits a wall. This is just as far as it can travel in co-moving coordinates. Of course, in proper distances, it can travel infinitely far. This is a co-moving distance. And if you multiply that with the scale factor at t equal infinity, well, that's an infinity itself, right? So of course, light, when traveling infinitely long, can travel infinitely far. But that's not our point. That would be confusing, because the two galaxies, A and B, also, after an infinite amount of time, will be infinitely far away from each other, right? So it makes much more sense to look at these distances in terms of co-moving coordinates. And what we find here is that the beam of light can only ever cross this much in terms of co-moving distance. Now remember that the co-moving distance between two galaxies is numerically always the same. Okay? So if the two galaxies are closer than this, the light will reach from A to B. If two galaxies are in terms of co-moving distance further away than that amount, other than this amount, then the light beam cannot make it there. So that means that the critical distance critical co-moving distance is this one. That's the size of the horizon. Now, of course, in principle, A and B, the galaxies A and B, could both send emissaries. They could send ambassadors towards each other to meet. And the question is, when could they meet? Well, if each one of them can travel with the speed of light, or almost the speed of light, then the maximum distance that two galaxies can still apart, so that the ambassadors will meet in the middle, would be twice. Twice that critical distance there. Okay, so that's the co-moving distance that the beam of light can travel. Now let's translate that into the proper distance that the two galaxies had when the beam of light was sent out. Right? When the beam of light was sent out, the time was t equal to ts, starting time. Remember that the proper distance, the proper distance between two points in space are given by the co-moving distance multiplied with the scale factor. So this is the co-moving distance, the critical co-moving distance that two galaxies can be apart to just be able to send signals to each other at time ts, when we sent the beam. How far apart are such two galaxies in terms of proper distance? Well, we just have to take that co-moving distance, here it is, and multiply it with the scale factor to get the proper distance at the time that the signal is being emitted. You see that those two exponentials cancel each other, and we're just left with this, which is to say that if at a starting time, there are two galaxies and at some point in time, one galaxy wants to send a signal to the other galaxy, then the signal will make it eventually over to the other galaxy if the proper distance between the two galaxies at the time of sending out the signal is given by 1 over h. So what we see here is that the faster the universe is expanding, the larger h is, the larger the Hubble constant is, the smaller is that distance, the proper distance. If the universe is expanding very rapidly, then galaxies that are relatively close to each other cannot communicate. If it's accelerating very slowly, then galaxies that are even far apart from each other may still be able to communicate. Now, what do you want to say here? Right. We have to integrate this this here up. And we did it for the case of De Sitter inflation. Well, let me tell you, let me get back to that a little later. I wanted to say something about cases where it's not De Sitter inflation. Let me just do that a little later. So, okay. I think I said all of those things already. So this holds for arbitrary starting times. A signal sent by A at any time can only ever reach B if at the sending time the proper distance between A and B was not exceeding 1 over h. Two observers that try to meet in the middle obviously have to have another distance threshold, which is twice as much. So now, yes, so that's just what I said. Now let's look at this in the wave picture. Waves are delocalized things, and unlike observers and wave packets that are individual localized signals, in general, plane waves will also feel the expansion of the universe and the presence of the horizon. But how will they feel it? How will they react to that? Let us look at Clank Gordon Moat. And the proposition is that Clank Gordon Moats oscillate as usual as long as their wavelengths are small compared to the Hubble horizon. However, when a wave has wavelengths such that the wavelength is larger than the Hubble horizon, then it turns out that those waves actually possess imaginary frequencies, which is to say that they will stop oscillating. If the field is a Klein-Gordon field, what we will find is that the amplitude of the field will freeze. Instead of oscillating, it will just freeze at a particular value. If we look not at the field phi, but instead at the field chi, which is given by phi times the scale factor, then we find that that chi field oscillates as usual as long as the wavelength is smaller than the Hubble horizon. And when the wavelength is larger than the Hubble horizon, then we will find that the chi field actually grows without bound. Pretty clear from what I said earlier, because the phi field freezes and the chi field is obtained by multiplying with the scale factor. Now let's calculate this through. For that purpose, let us switch to conformal time. Using conformal time, we need to express everything then in conformal time, in particular the scale factor. So we know that a of t, the proper time, is exponential in the case of the Sitter universe. What is a of eta? What is the scale factor as a function of the conformal time? And in any case, how is this conformal time related to the proper time in the case of the Sitter? Remember, this was the general relationship between the conformal time eta and the proper time as measured on a wristwatch t. The general relationship is this. Eta is the integral of 1 over a over the proper time, where I didn't put a lower integration bound because it's completely arbitrary. That's an integration constant, which simply specifies where we place the time equals 0 on the eta axis, or the time equals 0 on the t axis. So as we integrate to get from t to eta, which is easily done here, because the scale factor is exponential, 1 over the scale factor is exponential. We integrate this up, and we get that plus a constant. And you see, it's very much the same calculation as we did earlier to obtain the horizon. We had very similar equations there. So we expect a close relationship between the conformal time and the horizon. But for now, let's not worry about this. Let's just calculate what the conformal time is in terms of the proper time for the Sitter space. We do this integral. We get this expression plus an integration constant. And the integration constant simply shifts around where, at what time eta is equal to 0, right? Obviously, because it just depends on what we choose for c, we'll make eta equal to 0 at various different points. Now what we notice here is that there's something strange about the conformal time in the case of the Sitter space. Nothing to do with the physics, it's just the math that comes out a little weird. Namely, if we look at the infinite past, as we look at past infinity, t going to minus infinity, then we have that eta also goes to minus infinity, right? Because as t goes to minus infinity, we have e to the power of a positive number that grows, and with a negative sign. So the infinite past infinity, is given for t going to minus infinity, as usual, and also eta going to minus infinity. So far, so good. Now, what about the infinite future, though? Future infinity, proper time going to plus infinity, gives us a finite value for the conformal time, namely c. Because for t going to plus infinity, the infinite future, this term goes away. We're just left with that integration constant. Usually, for convenience, one chooses this constant to be equal to 0. So we have this relationship here, right, with c equal to 0. And that means that we have that eta of t is given by minus 1 over h, 1 over a of t. Right? Do you see how that comes about? Eta equal to minus 1 over h, and then this is really 1 over the scale factor, a of t. It's 1 over a of t. So we can write that the conformal time is given by minus 1 over the Hubble constant, 1 over the scale factor. This is a very useful relation. On one hand, because it gives us the conformal time in terms of the proper time, but also we can view this equation a little differently. This gives us the scale factor as a function of eta, right? Because h is a constant. So we get the scale factor right away as a function of eta. Namely, we obtain that the scale factor a is 1 over minus 1 over h eta. We can drop the variable t here, and we find that a as a function of eta is really minus 1 over h eta. So notice that what used to be exponential in this new time variable, the expansion used to be exponential in terms of the new time variable, the scale factor is just 1 over the time, 1 over conformal time. Now that doesn't look like a huge expansion anymore. It's no longer an exponential expansion. But it's still an infinite expansion. Of course, it describes the same physics, right? It's just in different coordinates. How do we see the expansion here? Well, remember that the past infinity is eta going to minus infinity. Okay, if eta goes to minus infinity, then the scale factor goes to 0. Fine. As it should be, shrinkage towards past infinity. Now, towards future infinity, the conformal time goes to 0. Remember? Conformal time ranges only over the negative half axis. So the conformal time goes from minus infinity to 0. And as the conformal time approaches from the negative 0, we have here, well, eta is negative always, right? So overall, the whole thing is positive. But as eta approaches 0 from the left, this thing blows up. And that's the scale factor that blows up. So we need to get used to this fact that the scale factor now blows up for finite conformal time, because the finite conformal time equals 0 corresponds to future infinity. Now we can go into these techniques that we developed earlier. We introduce for the physical field phi the auxiliary field chi, which differs from it just by the scale factor. Remember, the purpose was that to remove a friction type term from the Klein-Gordon equation for phi. In the special case here of the Sitter space, the scale factor is minus 1 over h eta. So this is explicitly what the relationship is between the physical field phi and the auxiliary field chi. Chi obeys, as always, this Klein-Gordon equation here. No friction term, frequency squared here, where the frequency squared is given, as usual, always by this expression. Now we can be more explicit, because we know what the scale factor is as a function of time, as a function of conformal time. So we can make it completely explicit now how this harmonic oscillator equation is time dependent. All we have to do is take that expression here and plug in for a minus 1 over h eta. And you notice that we have to calculate a second derivative of a here. So I leave it to you as an exercise to do this. Plug in the sitter scale factor function and work out what that is. Here's the answer. The frequency squared for the auxiliary field in terms of the expressed in terms of the co-moving momentum and conformal time is given in this way, where we recognize that the mass term is simply this, that's trivial to see. Here you just have to do a second derivative with respect to conformal time, and you get that term over here. Notice that this term here has no h in it. Bit weird, but that's how it comes out. It cancels out when you calculate the ratio of derivatives of the scale factor with respect to the scale factor, because it's just exponentials there. Okay, so that is the frequency squared for the auxiliary field. And we know, of course, from the previous lectures that what we have to look out for, namely situations where omega squared can go negative. Because that means that the frequency goes imaginary and the oscillator stops being an oscillator. What we see here is that this can happen. It can happen that this term dominates over the rest. Let's go through this in more detail. So we are checking for circumstances where we have imaginary frequencies. Remember, what we are really after at the moment, the section that we are doing at the moment is, or the theme of what we are doing at the moment is, what does a horizon mean for waves? We first studied what horizons mean for observers, or class observers. Now we study what horizons mean for fields and for waves. So in the case of the sitter space, we found that this is the frequency of the harmonic oscillators, and we check for imaginary frequencies. Obviously, you might expect that they might go imaginary above the horizon size. Let's see. Let's assume that the mass of the Klein-Gordon field is small compared to the Hubble horizon size. That is an assumption that in realistic inflationary scenarios is fulfilled. In this case, this particular term, which arises in the frequency squared, here it is. Here's the expression for the frequency squared. We have this particular term here. That particular term is then small. Particular, it's negative. Right? So our assumption is that the mass of the inflaton is not so large that it would turn this term dominant over that. Right? So if mass compared to the Hubble scale is large, then this is always positive, is always larger than that, and the frequency squared is always positive, and that would be it. No funny behavior in this case. But if the mass is small, and in fact, in most of what we do later, we will assume that it is zero, the mass is small, then you see that this term doesn't contribute much. This one is dominant, and we have a negative term here competing with the positive term over there, where this one doesn't have a time dependence. It's just a co-moving momentum. Doesn't have a time dependence, so therefore, this one will always win eventually because eta gets smaller, right? As time progresses, the conformal time variable eta approaches zero from the left, and therefore, this thing will blow up. As I just said, for every mode k, there comes a time when the frequency squared becomes negative. Now, when is that time? Well, it's when this, neglect the mass term for now, the switch from positive omega squared to negative omega squared happens when the time is so late that eta is so close to zero arriving from the left that this term is equal to that term. Afterwards, it will always be dominating over that term. So when is that? Well, it's when 2 over eta squared is equal to k squared, okay? Which is to say that this happens at the time eta equal to square root of 2 over k. So when the conformal time minus square root of 2 over k is reached, then the harmonic oscillator of the mode k flips sign. Consider a mode that has a very large k, just to get a feeling for what that means. Consider a mode that has a very large k. What does that mean? It means co-moving momentum is very large. It means that the co-moving wavelength is very small. So let's say it's a very, very small wavelength mode. In that case, this is a large number. When k is very large, so the wavelength is very small, then if this is very large, k is very large, this is a small number. It's a small negative number, which means that this time, the conformal time, is a small negative number, which means it's late. Because conformal time going to zero from the left means future infinity. The closer we are to zero, the later it is. What we see here is that the mode with co-moving momentum k will cross the horizon. I mean, we will say, later see that this is horizon crossing. The mode with momentum k will have its oscillation frequency go imaginary. The later, the shorter its wavelength is. Which is plausible, because the longer it takes for the wavelength to be stretched so that it reaches the Hubble horizon size. OK, so what we find is that a mode oscillates as long as the conformal time is larger than 1 over k, right? That's just what we said over here. I dropped the square root of 2 just by order of magnitude. I mean, this is just the transition, right, from minus, from negative to positive. So as long as the conformal time is much larger than 1 over k, I mean, the absolute value of the conformal time is much larger than 1 over k, we still have oscillation. So the large absolute value of eta means we are far to the left of zero on the real line. Early times, large eta modulus of eta means early times. At early times, so if eta is so early that the absolute value of eta is larger than 1 over k, then we still have oscillations. Or mathematically, we can also say that if the modulus of eta times k is larger than or equal to 1, is way larger than 1, then the modes are still oscillating. When eta gets so close to 0, which is to say if the time gets so late that the absolute value of eta becomes smaller than 1 over k, then we have imaginary frequencies. Now, let's look at what this threshold really means in terms of proper wavelengths. Remember that the conformal time is minus 1 over hA, so the absolute value of the conformal time is 1 over hA. If we multiply with k, which is 2 pi over L, then we obtain on the left-hand side the threshold number that we had above. Remember, what decides whether or not we are in the oscillatory or the non-oscillatory regime is the product of modulus of eta and k. Okay, so that product we need to get a handle on. So let us start with this relationship that we had at the very beginning today and multiply that with k on the left and right. But on the left, we will write it in terms of, we will write here k. On the right-hand side, instead of multiplying with k, we will multiply with 2 pi over L, which is the same thing. So we obtain then that eta k, that number that decides whether the mode is oscillating or not, given by 1 over hA. And then this is k again, expressed in terms of L, L being the co-moving distance, right? So co-moving momentum co-moving momentum is up to a factor of 2 pi, the co-moving distance. Sorry, not distance, wavelength, right? So co-moving momentum, co-moving wavelength. Okay, so we need to check whether this is larger or smaller than 1. Which is to say, we need to check whether this is larger or smaller than 1. But remember, A times L, this is the co-moving wavelength. Multiplying it with the scale factor gives us the proper wavelength. And all co-moving distances, when multiplied with the scale factor, give us the proper distances. This is a co-moving wavelength multiplied with the scale factor gives us the proper wavelength. Let us call the proper wavelength lambda. So lambda is scale factor times co-moving wavelength. Therefore, our condition, our criterion for whether the mode is oscillating or not hinges on this product, but equally well, it hinges on that. So the question was, is this smaller or is this larger than 1? Remember, it oscillates as long as this is larger than 1, which is to say the wave oscillates as long as this is larger than 1. So the wave oscillates as long as this is larger than 1. That was our condition from above, which is to say it oscillates if this is larger than 1. And now that condition we can rewrite like that by putting lambda on one side and 2 pi over h on the other side. And we can drop the factor of 2 pi for the purpose here. So the wave will oscillate as long as its wavelength, its proper physical wavelength, is smaller than the Hubble horizon. Okay, so now we see what the existence of such a horizon means for waves. It means that they keep oscillating as long as their proper wavelength is smaller than the Hubble distance, the Hubble horizon. But as soon as the wavelength grows larger than the horizon size, they stop oscillating, and instead the frequency goes imaginary. Waves of the physical phi field will, as we will later see, stop oscillating altogether, and they just freeze. Waves of the chi fields don't freeze, because the chi field is the phi field multiplied with a scale factor. So the chi fields actually will grow without bound, because the scale factor grows without bound. But either way, freezing or growing is not oscillating. Yeah, and that's just the flip side of the coin. When that product is smaller than 1, then we have non-oscillatory behavior, and that's when the wavelength is larger than the horizon size. Okay, so far we studied the Sitter space, a spacetime that is exponentially expanding, that has been exponentially expanding forever, and will be exponentially expanding forever. That's not exactly realistic. It's more realistic to assume that spacetime expanded like that, expanded almost exponentially, only for a finite period of time. So let's assume that spacetime expanded exponentially, like the Sitter space, but only temporarily, between some initial time, eta I, and some final time, eta f. Later we will try to improve on that model. We will improve on that model by no longer assuming that it's even exponential, but it is a little sub-exponential. It's much more realistic to assume that it's expanding very rapidly, but not quite exponentially. Anyway, for now, to make it a little bit more realistic, let's just confine the exponential expansion to a finite interval in time. And to keep things really simple, let's assume that spacetime was Minkowski-like before and will be Minkowski-like after. So there's a Minkowski period, then there is exponential expansion, then it's Minkowski again, with some smooth transition between the three phases. A key equation that we need to remember from what we had above is this. Remember that in the sitter space, the time when a mode crosses the horizon, that horizon crossing conformal time eta was given by minus square root of 2 over k. Remember, that's when I said that when the comoving wavelength, when the comoving momentum is very large, so the wavelength is short, this is a very small number, close to zero, which means it's a late time, because future infinity is actually zero. Okay. Expressing this in terms of the comoving wavelength, we see that the horizon crossing time for a wave of comoving wavelength L is basically the comoving wavelength L itself. The space and time are related by the speed of light, of course, but we set that equal to 1 in our units, so they have the same unit. So up to a decorative factor of square root of 2 pi, the horizon crossing time for a mode of wavelength L is just L, or minus L. All conformal times are negatives, of course, Okay, so there we see it again. If the wavelength is large, then the horizon crossing time is going to be an eta that's far to the left on the real axis, which means an early time. If the wavelength is small, then eta is closer to zero, which means it's a later time. But it's good to keep in mind that the wavelength, the comoving wavelength, gives you pretty much directly the horizon crossing time up to a sign. And what we find here is that, in particular, there will now be modes whose comoving momentum is such, or their comoving wavelength is such, that the horizon crossing time is simply not in the interval where we have exponential expansion. So there will be modes which have too short wavelengths. The universe tries its best to expand them, but by the time the inflation is over, by the time the exponential expansion is over, the wavelength still hasn't reached the horizon size. And in fact, there are also going to be modes which have such long wavelengths that even when the expansion starts, the exponential expansion starts, they already have larger than horizon wavelength. And we'll always have. So you see, we have three kinds of modes to distinguish here. Modes that are so small, they never cross the horizon because inflation ends before that. Modes that are of medium size, those will be the ones of cosmological significance. Modes which will cross the horizon during the time of inflation, between eta initial and eta final, during the time of exponential growth. And then there are modes which, when the exponential expansion started, were already having a wavelength larger than the horizon size. Okay, so let's just formalize the three cases. There are those small modes. Small modes are such that the horizon crossing time is larger than eta final, so those will never make it across. And then, and that means that the comoving wavelength is smaller than the time of the ending of the inflationary period. As we will find out, the quantum fluctuations of such modes will not get amplified. Expansion or not, inflation or not, exponential or not, doesn't matter. For those modes, we still have the usual spectrum of the quantum fluctuations. The usual spectrum, if you remember, is 1 over L. The size of quantum fluctuations in a box of size L, the standard deviation of those quantum fluctuations goes like 1 over L. Large boxes have small amplitude quantum fluctuations. Small boxes have large amplitudes, like 1 over L. Those modes will still have the 1 over L law. Then there are the medium-sized modes. Obviously, these are the ones where the horizon crossing time is somewhere between the start and the finishing of the period of exponential expansion. These will be of great interest, and we will study them in all detail. And then there are the large modes. These are modes that were larger than, whose wavelength was larger than the horizon size already when the exponential expansion started. And in the inflationary scenario, those are modes that are today very much larger than the visible universe. Wavelengths way larger than 14 billion light years. One might think that they do not contribute. Well, they effectively contribute constants, right? Because we don't see any variation due to them. Because whatever they do, it's at a wavelength larger than what we see. But then some authors have picked up on that and said, well, okay, they can generate a constant. As far as we are concerned, we just see a constant. Maybe the cosmological constant is generated in this way. Just an idea. So then let's calculate quantum fluctuations in the Sitter space, especially for the case of those medium-sized modes, modes whose wavelength will cross the Hubble horizon while the inflation is happening. We pursue the usual ansatz, auxiliary field expressed in terms of mode functions and raising and lowering operators. And it will work as long as we succeed in solving the two basic equations here, the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition. Remember, that's the condition that ensures that the AA-Dagger commutation relations translate properly into the commutation relations between the chi field and its canonically conjugate. So here we have the Klein-Gordon equation with its two complex dimensional Hilbert space of solutions, and here the Wronskian condition, which is nonlinear because it's quadratic in V. In the case of the Sitter space, we can solve that thing. And that is very useful. Here are two basic solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation in the Sitter space. They are this, a function u k of eta and a function u bar k of eta. They are not complex conjugates of each other. The bar just indicates another solution. They are real valued. We have two real valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and they span the two complex dimensional space of solutions. The solutions are in terms of the so-called Bessel J and Bessel Y functions. Maple or Mathematica have them, of course, built in. You can assume them to be known and plottable and usable for all sorts of purposes. What are they? What kind of behavior might they have? Well, at very early times, we know that this Klein-Gordon equation is basically like the Klein-Gordon equation of Minkowski space. Because at very early time, the conformal time is a very large negative number. Those terms drop out, and we are just dealing with the Klein-Gordon equation of Minkowski space. We will get back to that in a moment. But for now, it's important to realize that this is so, because that tells us what those guys have to do at early times, when eta is very much negative in the far past. Well, then this becomes basically the Klein-Gordon equation for Minkowski space, and those guys better reduce to just simple oscillations. And since they are two real-valued solutions, one of them has got to be cosine, the other one has got to be sine, and that's what they are. If you look at those solutions, if you plot them for really early times, they're going to be just like sine and cosine. For late times, that's not so. And they might even stop oscillating at late times, because our harmonic oscillator is going to have an imaginary frequency. But at early times, this is just sine and cosine. So those two Bessel functions are really generalizations of sine and cosine for harmonic oscillators. For this particular time-dependent harmonic oscillator, it starts out completely harmonic as usual, but then changes its frequency until the frequency becomes zero And then the frequency squared becomes negative, which is to say the frequency becomes imaginary. And this just integrates over the whole thing. It's just a complete solution to the problem, even with this complicated time-dependent behavior of the harmonic oscillator. One of the reasons why the Sitter space is considered, because you can calculate all that stuff. Those so-called Bessel J and Bessel Y functions have an index n, and that is just a dummy variable so that we don't have to write a big expression here. Because you see, there's a family of Bessel J functions, there's a family of Bessel Y functions, they depend on a variable here, and that variable is given by this. So in principle, we would have to put that square root in here, but I just defined here an n, and that's what it is. You notice that we assumed that the mass is small compared to the Hubble scale, in which case this term is negligible, and we have that n is 3/2. So keep in mind that in what follows, we can keep n general, but in practice, n is going to be very close to 3/2, because the mass is small compared to the Hubble scale. All right, so we have now a basis for the solution space of the Klein-Gödel equation. Now, remember that if you want to actually calculate something in quantum field theory, we need to identify the state that the system is in. And we usually do that by identifying the vacuum state. We assume that the system started out in the vacuum state. And vacuum states can be specified by specifying a mode function. Remember, a mode function comes with A and A dagger operators, and then the A operator annihilates a vector. And it's very convenient to choose a mode function such that the vector that's annihilated by its A operator happens to be the vacuum state. And what we see now is that since we already identified two solutions of our Klein-Gödel equation, we have a basis in the space of solutions. Therefore, the choice of A and A daggers, the choice of mode functions, choice of vacuum, all of this, all of those choices simply boil down to a choice of linear combination of these guys, right? The proper mode function that we need for physical purposes is going to be a linear combination of these two, which is to say we can fix it by just giving two numbers. How much of this, how much of that? So the proper mode function that describes, that comes with A and A dagger operators, whose A operator annihilates a vector zero, which happens to be the state that our quantum field is in, that mode function is going to be some linear combination of those two guys. That's guaranteed, right? So it's some constant A in front of U and some constant B in front of U bar. And of course, these things, you have to do it for every mode K separately. Every mode K has its two-dimensional solution space, etc. So what we need to find now is those complex coefficients, AK and BK, so that we get the right mode function here. How can we identify that? How can we identify the state of the system? Well, first, we check whether the modes start out in an adiabatic regime. And the small and the medium modes do. Okay, because the small modes start out smaller than the Hubble length. Its their wavelength is smaller than the Hubble length. And it, in fact, always stays smaller than the Hubble length. The medium modes medium-sized wavelength modes, start out with their wavelength smaller than the Hubble length. And then only later does their wavelength grow to become larger than the Hubble length. So at early enough times, for small and medium-sized modes, we can assume that they were in a regime where the where their wavelength was way smaller than the Hubble length. That's not true for the large wavelength modes, which started out even at wavelengths larger than the Hubble radius. For them, it's not so easy to argue what their quantum state is. But it turns out that they won't actually matter much in cosmology, except that they might be responsible for some constant, right? Because they, as far as we can tell, they are just constant over, across the universe that we can see. Okay, so then we postulate, as we exercised in previous lectures, that the state omega that our quantum field is in was, at early times, the adiabatic vacuum. And of course, by the by using the Heisenberg picture, that's always the state that the system is in. It's the, all the evolution is in the operators then. So we choose then mode functions vk for our modes, at least for the small and medium-sized ones. We choose mode functions whose associated vector 0 is the adiabatic vacuum early on. And once we have those mode functions, then we have the time evolution of all operators in the theory, right? Because we get, once we have the mode function, we get phi of x and t. We get pi of x and t, chi of x and t, everything. We can express everything, the time evolution of everything. So once we have them in particular, we can then calculate what the quantum fluctuations of the field are at any time we wish. Namely, here's the formula, if you remember. Once we know that the system is in a state, once we know that our quantum field is in that state 0, which comes along with the mode function v, then the amount of quantum fluctuations, the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations, at an arbitrary time eta, which we may choose to be, for example, the end time of the inflationary period, the size of the quantum fluctuations then is given by 1 over scale factor squared, and then k to the third power, and then the modulus squared of the chi mode function. Just have to find out what that mode function is. But we just said how we get at it. We get at it by identifying the mode function at early times. Once we identify what it is at early times, well, then the time evolution of the Klein-Gordon equation will tell us what the v is at late times, and we can plug it in here and calculate those things. So the strategy is going to be identify v at early times and then run the time evolution. In fact, we're going to be able to do that quite easily because we already have explicit solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Everything is linear combinations of that. So we just need to find out what linear combination of our two basis solutions u and u bar v was at early times. And then once we have that, you know, that linear combination, it's the same thing, right? It's at all time. So once we have that, once we know that v is a linear combination of u and u bar, which particular linear combination of u and u bar it is, then we can tell what v is at late time from knowing what the evolution of u and u bar is. And that will tell us what the quantum fluctuations are. And that's the general strategy that can be employed, and we will employ over and over again in the next few lectures, to calculate what the quantum fluctuations are of the intraturn field, of the metric, and the famous bipolarization and so on. All right, so I already anticipated it a little bit. Let us look at the Klein-Gordon equation at early time, because we need to identify v, right? We need to identify the mode function as a linear combination of this u and u bar, as a linear combination of the Bessel J and Bessel Y function, that is. So here's the Klein-Gordon equation, and at very early times, when eta is a very, very negative number, these two terms are basically absent, and we are left with just v double prime plus k squared v equal to 0. That's the straightforward, simple, time-dependent, time-independent harmonic oscillator of Minkowski space, this one. And we know what the solutions there are. And we assume that we know that the universe started out in the vacuum state at that point. Actually, as we will study later, this is not a strong assumption. The universe may have been filled with stuff, but the rapid expansion will dilute it away. For now, let's just assume that it started out without stuff. It was just empty, vacuum, the Minkowski vacuum. So at early times, we have the usual Klein-Gordon equation and the vacuum. Well, we know what VK looks like then. Namely, so the vacuum at early times is the vector zero for certain A and A dagger operators, and that's the state of our system here. And it's the vacuum state is the vector zero for the A and A dagger operators that come along with the mode function that is given by this expression here. If you remember, far back early in this course, we quantized the scalar field on Minkowski space, and that was the mode function. The alpha is just some arbitrary phase that you can always add. If we neglect the mass term, we can re-express the omega in terms of k, right? Because then omega is really k squared plus m squared. Omega squared is k squared plus m squared. If the mass is not important, omega squared is k squared. And so we can replace the omega by the modulus of k, of k vector. Remember that when I just write k, it means the modulus of the length of the vector k. Okay, so the mode function has this behavior at early time. This is the mode function that identifies the vacuum of early times, and therefore the state in which the quantum field is always going to be in on the time evolution in the operators. So that's the behavior of the mode function at early times. What happens to this mode function at late times? You can find out by finding out what linear combination this is of the u and the u bar. Here's a technical observation. At early times, as we anticipated, the solution u of the Klein-Gordon equation is basically a cosine. At early times, the other basic solution to the Klein-Gordon equation is basically a sine. And therefore, here's the proposition, and I leave that to you as an exercise, and can prove that in terms of the two basic solutions u and u bar, our mode function vk, which has this Minkowski behavior at early times, is given by this linear combination. So these are the linear combination coefficients. Here are the basis functions in the solution space to the Klein-Gordon equation. So vk is square root of pi over 2k, and this one has this coefficient is minus I square root of pi over 2k. All you have to do is check what exactly that is at very early times and match it with this. Well, you may need a non-zero alpha there, but that's an unimportant factor, just a constant. Okay, so this means that overall, our mode function is given by this expression. At early times, that's just the plane wave, e to the I omega eta. But at late times, this is very much more complicated. But we know it explicitly. And therefore, we can write down what phi hat of x and t is, for example, at any arbitrary time, because we can express our physical field in terms of the mode function and the A and A dagger operator. So we have everything now. The quantum field theory is completely solved for all time. In particular, we can calculate the size of the quantum fluctuations as a function of k at an arbitrary time, such as at the time when the exponential inflation has ended. Remember, this was the general formula for that. You take k to the third power, and this is the variance, k to the third power, and then this divided by that, it's just the modulus squared of the mode function of phi. This is the mode function of chi. Let us consider the three kinds of modes. The small ones, whose wavelength never makes it across the horizon, and then the medium ones, and then the big one. So first the small ones, this is still the boring part, but just to exercise how this goes, let's do it anyway. These, the very small modes are those whose comoving momentum is large enough so that in this Klein-Gordon equation, the k squared term in omega squared dominates throughout. Okay, so this thing is positive, and it just dominates completely over that for all time. Before this thing could before eta can go small enough, close enough to zero, so that this would change the sign overall, the sitter inflation ends, and therefore this term goes away entirely. Or, you know, the acceleration becomes much less, and therefore this becomes much less of a dominant term. So in this case, we always have oscillations going on, in spite of the oscillations being time dependent. Well, they don't change, omega squared doesn't change sign. Now, these modes never cross the horizon, and therefore, approximately, we have at all time that the modes behave like this, roughly. Therefore, the vacuum fluctuations at the end of the exponential expansion are still in Minkowski space. And if you plug that mode function into the equation for the fluctuation spectrum, then what do you get? Just a sec. The fluctuation spectrum equation is here. So a to the power minus 2, k to the third, modulus squared. So we need, so this is 1 over this, this is the square root of what is up there. Up there it was the variance, here's the standard deviation. 1 over scale factor, and then k to the third was up here, k to the 3 half, because it's, we take the square root. And then the modulus squared of the field. Well, we take the square root of that, it's just the modulus of it. And the modulus of the field's mode function, the modulus of this is just 1 over square root of k. So we just get a 1 over square root of k here. And that gives us overall A inverse, and I'm carrying this forward from here to here, A inverse. And then we have k to the 3 half divided by k to the power 1 half. That just gives us a k, which we can also write as 1 over L. So overall, the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations of size L are given by 1 over scale factor times co-moving wavelength. But co-moving wavelength multiplied with the scale factor gives us the proper wavelength. So overall, we recover a result that we had earlier, namely that the standard deviation of the fluctuations of wavelength lambda goes down like 1 over lambda. As usual, just like Minkowski space. But no wonder, because it's the same mode function as Minkowski space. So the conclusion is that for small wavelength modes, those modes that never cross the horizon, the Hubble horizon, the fluctuations with proper spatial extent are still suppressed. Right? This is a huge suppression here. The larger the wavelength, the smaller is the standard deviation of the fluctuations. Now, case two, medium-sized modes. These are those modes which have k such that during the exponential expansion, their wavelength reaches the Hubble horizon length and then exceeds it. So omega squared changes sign during the evolution. And the horizon crossing time is between the initial time and the final time of the exponential expansion. Now, let us calculate the fluctuation spectrum in this case. As before, the standard deviation is given by 1 over scale factor times mode function. That's, of course, just the mode function of the phi field. And then power of 3 half for k. And we evaluate that when the inflation is over. By the way, just as a comment, the Klein-Gordon equation in this scenario is to a good approximation given by, let me just show you here. See, when at the end of inflation, at the end of the exponential expansion, this term is dominating over that term for the medium size mode. So let's neglect that. I mean, we are neglecting the mass term anyway. So let's neglect these things. Then we have a differential equation, which is V double prime minus 2 over eta squared V equal to 0. Pretty simple differential equation. And even if we didn't have those Bessel function solutions, we could still read off what the solutions are. At least we could read off two basis solutions for late times in this way. Because that differential equation is just simple enough to do it. It's this differential equation. And at late times, these are two basic solutions. Don't need them because we have the u and the u bar. Nevertheless, let's look at them just to get a feel for what's going on. So here we have a solution W1. And that's just a solution which is proportional to eta squared. You see, when we have a V which is proportional to eta squared, then we have the second derivative is a constant. And here we have that this is proportional to eta squared divided by eta squared also gives us a constant. This can work out, right? So one solution of the Klein-Gordon equation at late times, when modes have far crossed the Hubble horizon, is that W is just going like eta squared. Another solution is given by 1 over eta. It's proportional to 1 over eta. How does that work out? Well, let's take this term here. We have to differentiate 1 over eta twice. That gets us down to 1 over eta squared, 1 over eta to the third, 1 over eta to the third. Here we have 1 over eta multiplied with 1 over eta squared. Also 1 over eta to the third. And these are the proper constants in front. So overall, we see that there is going to be a set of two solutions. Sorry, as a two-dimensional solution space. And here we have two independent solutions that will span that space. One of them goes like eta squared. The other one goes like 1 over eta. And that means, in particular, the following. This one dies. As eta goes to 0, which is to say for the future infinity, that mode solution goes to 0 because eta does. Eta goes to 0 from the left. Conformal time goes to 0 from the left for the future infinity. Whereas this term blows up. It blows up like 1 over eta for towards future infinity. Blows up like 1 over eta. Another thing also blows up like 1 over eta. Remember what that is? Any guesses? The scale factor. Right? The scale factor in terms of the conformal time also blows up like 1 over eta. And remember, that's the mode functions for the chi field. In order to get to the mode function for the phi field, you actually have to divide by the mode function. You have to divide by the scale factor. So what we see is this goes like 1 over eta. The scale factor goes like 1 over eta. The whole thing goes to a constant. So the physical mode function will go towards one of the basic solutions will go to a constant, and the other one will go to 0. But as far as the chi field is concerned, one will go to 0 and the other one will blow up. Okay, so indeed, well, we don't have to rely on these estimates here because we have the proper solutions. We have explicit solutions for all time. And we can check that the Bessel functions, Bessel J and Bessel Y functions, have this property. Namely, the two basic basis solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that we wrote down earlier have that asymptotic behavior. As eta goes to 0, so for future infinity at late times towards the end of inflation, we have a behavior like this, where we have proportionality to eta to the power of n plus 1/2. Remember that n is one of those coefficients here in the Bessel functions, And it is approximately 3/2. If the mass is not zero, it's not quite 3/2. If the mass is zero, it's exactly 3/2. So if the mass is equal to zero, this is exactly 3/2, and this is to the power of eta squared, matching what we just anticipated here, right? There's one solution that goes like eta squared. On the other hand, there's this other solution here, which goes like eta to the power of 1/2 minus 3/2. Right? I mean, if there's no mass, then we have minus 3/2. 1/2 minus 3/2 is minus 1. So this goes like 1 over eta. And that blows up for late time. That's the solution that we have to watch out for. But we also notice here that it's good that we have the exact solution, because that one gives us the right answer even when there is a finite mass to worry about. And we see how it changes the behavior a little bit. OK, so now we know what linear combination the actual physical mode function V is of those two. Right? The physical V is a linear combination of those two. And we found out what the linear combination coefficients are. And if we just plug that in, we find that the physical mode function's asymptotic behavior, given those two asymptotic behaviors, is dominated by this term here. And we are left with just that. In principle, there's a second term, which is a linear combination of the U. You see, the V has U bar in it, and it has U in it. But the U goes away, it goes to 0. The U bar doesn't. It's this term here. OK, so at late times, or towards the time when the inflation ends, late enough for the mode to have properly crossed the horizon, the mode's wavelength to be significantly larger than the horizon, then we have that the mode function is given by this. Now it's a term that goes like 1 over eta, essentially, if there's no mass. The modulus of that is what matters when we calculate the quantum fluctuations. Here in black, I just put reminders of the formulas that were 10 slides above, so that you don't have to scroll too much if you want to check that calculation. OK, so here we have the formula again for this standard deviation of the quantum fluctuation of comoving length L. And it's, as usual, given by 1 over scale factor multiplied with k to the power of 3/2. That's over here. And then you see this is 1 over the scale factor here. This is k to the power 3/2. And here we have the modulus of the mode function. That's over here. A little busy, this formula over there, but it simplifies. Simplifies because look at it. We have here k to the power 3/2. Here we have a k to the power 1/2. Just gives us a k. So we have arising here eta times k. And over here we also have eta times k. And we can just add up the powers. Here we have to the power of 1. Eta to the power 1, k also to the power of 1, because the cancellation is here. And then here we have to the power of 1/2 minus n. So overall, what we get is that the size of the fluctuations is given by the Hubble constant times eta times k, which is really eta divided by l, to the power of 3/2 minus n. And then those factors are just carried forward from over here. These are just constants of order 1. So the prediction ultimately is that if there is a temporary period of exponential expansion, it will cause the quantum fluctuations of medium-sized modes, modes that cross the horizon during the expansion, to have this behavior here. Notice that the eta dependence dropped out. How did that happen? Well, we had 3/2 minus n. If there's no mass, or if the mass is very small, n is 3/2. Therefore, all of this drops out. And then we have this amazing finding that the size of the quantum fluctuations inside the box, averaged inside the box of size L, is actually a constant. Doesn't depend on the size of the box anymore. Right? So usually, the quantum fluctuations get the smaller, the larger the box is over which we average. But here we find, no, it's the same size, no matter what size box it is. Let us put the two cases together. We saw that modes that are so small that their wavelength never approaches the Hubble horizon behave as usual. So the fluctuations go down like 1 over L in the size of the box. In particular, for a co-moving mode, its wavelength will increase, and therefore the fluctuations will go down. The size of the fluctuations will go down. And I mean, sorry, in terms of, instead of talking about a box, we might as well talk about wavelength. So what we have is that in Minkowski space, as well as for the small modes, small wavelength modes, we have that the amplitude of the quantum fluctuations goes like 1 over L, where L is the wavelength of the mode. Now, that's the usual picture in Minkowski space. In an expanding space-time, our modes have increasing wavelengths because they get stretched along with the expansion of space-time. Therefore, normally, the fluctuations of a mode become smaller and smaller and smaller, because a mode starts out at small wavelengths where it's legal for it to have a large amount of fluctuations. But then as the mode gets stretched to larger and larger wavelengths, then it is enforced that the quantum fluctuations become smaller and smaller, just because it's a longer wavelength mode. But that's not true for modes. That's only true as long as the wavelength of the mode doesn't quite reach the Hubble horizon yet. As soon as the, so we expect the following behavior. You start out with a mode. It has a very small wavelength, therefore very large amplitude fluctuations. Now, the wavelength will increase during the expansion. The fluctuations amplitude will decrease until the wavelength hits the horizon. From then onwards, when the wavelength is as big as the horizon or larger than the horizon, then the quantum fluctuations amplitude stays the same. Even though as the universe keeps expanding, the wavelength keeps expanding, the fluctuations still keep the same amplitude. So here's the picture of that. Here's the picture of this. Here is the wavelength of a mode, the proper wavelength of a mode. Over time, the proper wavelength of a mode will increase, right? So let's not look yet at the curve. So you start out with a wave of wavelength very small. It will have large amplitude fluctuations, and then its wavelength will grow. Wavelength will grow along with the universe. It just gets stretched out. And what we have just calculated is that for the so-called small modes, the wavelength will be very small initially, the quantum fluctuations very large, and then they will get larger and larger wavelength. The quantum fluctuations will decrease. And then for the small modes, their wavelengths might be around here when inflation ends. And that's it. But other modes, the medium-sized modes, will perhaps have started with that sort of wavelength. Their quantum fluctuations were this much. So this is a log-log plot. So in principle, it's like 1 over L and then constant. But here we have, because it's a log-log plot, a straight line for that 1 over L decay. The medium-sized modes start out with a small wavelength, large amplitude fluctuations, and then their wavelength increases, their fluctuation size decreases. But as the wavelength starts to exceed the Hubble horizon size, their quantum fluctuations remain at the same level all the time. Now, if the Hubble horizon is on the order of a kilometer, let's just think of just as an example. Imagine a universe in which the Hubble horizon is a kilometer, which means that anybody, any couple who finds themselves a kilometer apart will never meet again. Sad story. 1 kilometer Hubble horizon. What does it mean in our case? Not much. Because what it means is that modes, I mean, of course, this will be a universe that expands dramatically, right? Kilometer, imagine. So if they're a kilometer apart, then even light cannot cross a kilometer, because in the meantime, space will have increased by more than the light can cross, right? So it's already a very explosive universe, that sort of thing. But let's imagine that for a moment. What it means is that a mode whose wavelength is like 900 meters is going to have quantum fluctuations of a certain size. Then the wavelength a little later will be a kilometer, and then it will be 2 kilometers and so on. And the quantum fluctuations will then always be the same size. The quantum fluctuations will always be of the amplitude that is typical for wavelengths of a kilometer, right? Because it decayed as usual, as in Minkowski space, down to a kilometer, and then it stayed the same, the level of the quantum fluctuation. But how big are quantum fluctuations for waves of a wavelength of a kilometer? We don't see them in daily life, right? They're so tiny, you don't see them. And yet, okay, and then imagine now we look at a universe that is a little bit more volatile than that. So now the Hubble horizon is just a meter. You just stand opposite, you're never going to meet again. So Hubble horizon of a meter, it exponentially increases in size, even faster than this. Then what it means is that modes will have their amplitude of quantum fluctuation frozen at the level that is typical for modes of a wavelength of 1 meter. Even if the wavelength is far larger than a meter, they still fluctuate as if they had a wavelength of a meter. But there's not much fluctuation going on at a wavelength of a meter. It's so suppressed. We're averaging over too much. Now, the outrageous claim of inflationary cosmology is that all the inhomogeneities in the universe, such as galaxies and galaxy clusters, and ultimately us, were originating in quantum fluctuation. They have to be of some significant size to do that. So the Hubble horizon really has to be much smaller than a meter in order to get quantum fluctuations of some significant power that can actually have an impact on the primordial gas, so that it will really trigger condensation into galaxies in a particular way that's dominated by that. So how small does the Hubble horizon have to have been during inflation, such that the quantum fluctuations were frozen at a small enough length scale, so that they were really large enough fluctuations to have a cosmological impact? Now, the numbers, as we will see in later lectures, come out in such a way that the Hubble horizon had to have been probably around 10 to the minus 28, 10 to the minus 29 meters. You can imagine how violent this expansion was. If even two friends that were only 10 to the minus 28 meters apart never meet again. Okay, but you see the point, right? The smaller the Hubble horizon is, 1 over h, the larger h is, the larger the expansion rate is, the earlier we catch the fluctuations of a mode. And the catching means no longer letting it go smaller, right? As soon as a wavelength exceeds the Hubble length, it keeps its fluctuation size. And only if the Hubble length is very small, only if the Hubble horizon is very small, are the fluctuations of the fields still really large, and then preserved until the fields are very large. Remember, the idea is that modes of wavelengths like 10 to the minus 27, 28, 29 meters were fluctuating, were crossing the horizon, were having large amplitude fluctuations, and the universe kept expanding them from a size of 10 to the minus 28 meters to perhaps the size of an orange, or perhaps the size of, I don't know, a gazillion times the size of the visible universe, and still keeping the fluctuations at the same level as they were when the wave was 10 to the minus 28 meters long. Right, okay, so we will successively make these things more realistic in the next few lectures then. Okay, that's it for today.